Welcome to the Devils in the Details radio show live on SkidRowStudios.com. Here's your host, Juan Russell.
Because the land of love and freedom is just...
Welcome to the Devils in the Details radio show once again. I thank you for joining me on this beautiful Friday we're having today here in scummy but warm downtown Los Angeles. My name is Wyme Russell, of course, and I would like to thank you for listening live here on SkidRowStudios.com. Now, today, I am not riding this love wagon alone. Riding shotgun with me, I have the newest star of his first national televised commercial, comedian and host of Registered Ear Offenders here on SkidRowStudios.com, Mr. Sal Rodriguez.
Thank you, Wyme. How are you doing, man? My pleasure to be here, man.
Good, man. Hey, I love having you here. It's always nice to spend an hour with a friend and go through some needed information.
So. And today's topic is going to get me riled up. It will.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. So here we go. So we have no time to waste because we do have a full show for you. Let's get started. Today, what we're going to do is we are going to attack the war on drugs. And we're going to do that Wyme and Sal's way.
Going to be a war on the war.
That's right. And we're going to have fun, and we're going to learn at the same time. So today on the Devils in the Details radio show, this is Wyme's History of High, Culture or Conspiracy. I ask you. Now let's go ahead and get started. Here we go.
What do you mean he's high?
So let's start back with the what we're going to do today is we're just going to discuss the history of drugs in America from, you know, the early 1900s or, you know, our modern times to current times. So we're going to kind of go through it decade by decade and kind of discuss the, hoax, should we say, for better term, for loss of words. For what the drug war has become.
Okay, so we're not going to go back in time to pre-colonialism.
We'll briefly discuss a few of those things, but how do you feel? Let me just start off with you, man. How do you feel about the current state of the war on drugs?
Well, I'd have to start with the war itself. And also the word war, like George Carlin always said, how we declare war on everything. Everything, we have such a war-minded mentality. Everything's the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on this, the war on that. I would have to say I definitely am. I was going to say straight out, I believe every individual should have a right to consume or do whatever they want to their own bodies. And I don't know why a lot of pro-abortionists or a lot of pro-choice people do not get up in arms about the drug movement, because an abortion is a woman deciding what she wants to do with her own body. And drug use is a person deciding what they want to do with their own body. To me, it falls under the same category.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Sure. Personal choices. What we do to our own bodies is, of course, should be our, God-given rights or inalienable right to proceed any way we see fit, as long as it has to do with our own bodies and not obviously hurting anybody else.
Sure.
So let's first look at the, of course, that was Cab Calloway from 1932. So if you listen to the song, in 1932, they were talking about the reefer man.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're way back in time. I mean, thousands of years go back in time, and they have always been doing drugs. There has always been drugs available on the earth, whether natural or some sort of synthetic process. But drugs have always been available, man. I mean, has there ever been a point in your life where drugs weren't readily available whenever you needed them, or
whenever I needed them, or whenever I was offered them?
Did you? Oh, was there ever a time where you couldn't get drugs? And I'm talking about street drugs.
No. But you know, this might have to do with the neighborhood I grew up in. I mean, all I had to do was walk up the street to the projects, and I could have my fill of whatever I wanted at the time. But the first drug. I don't call weed a drug, really. We'll call cocaine a drug.
All right.
And so I was a teenager. I was at a party, and this guy said, he said to me, he goes, "Hey, get a coca," he said in Spanish, "get a coca." And so I went into the bathroom and we did a line of coke.
Wow.
In the bathroom. This was a grown man and I was a teenager at the time.
Okay.
But, I liked it. I thought, this is great. I didn't really want to keep doing it again.
Okay.
But I thought, oh, this is interesting.
But you gave it a shot.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's just break down quickly what the drugs are. So let's give a basic history of what the biggies are. So let's start with heroin. Do you kind of know the history of heroin?
No. I want to talk because it has organic properties. It has organic roots.
It does. It's from the poppy, so opium poppy. So let's check this out. So in the mid to late 1800s, opium was a fairly popular drug. So it was a popular thing. Opium, I guess they made morphine out of it and all of that kind of
stuff.
And
in Asia, they had the old opium dens. I remember hearing about that.
Right. And they also had those in the Wild West. So all over America, back in the cowboy days, you found these opium dens. So it was quite common. But it was from opium that morphine, a derivative, was developed as a painkiller approximately around 1810. So it was considered a wonder drug because it eliminated severe pain associated with medical operations or traumatic injuries. It left the user in a completely numb, euphoric dream state, which is, because of the intense euphoric side effects, the drug in 1811 was named after the Greek god of dreams, Morpheus. Which is interesting. Unfortunately, the addictive properties of the drug on the flip side went virtually unnoticed until after the Civil War. So everybody was getting hooked on it because it was the way to feel better from all these wounds and surgeries, mm-hmm. and people were getting hooked. And they didn't realize that until obviously after the Civil War. Now, by the mid-1850s, morphine was available in the United States and became more and more popular with the medical profession. So I guess doctors started to use it more and more. The benefits of using the drugs to treat severe pain was considered nothing short of remarkable to the doctors at the time. So it was like a miracle drug. You know, this was, long before aspirin and far more powerful. So by 1874, the answer to this increasing problem was thought to be found. So by 1874, the answer to this increasing problem was thought to be found in the invention of a new drug in Germany. This new wonder drug was called heroin. So they invented it in Germany. And after its German trademark name, heroin, crazy, huh, was imported into the United States shortly after it was invented. Now, the sales pitch that created an instant market to the American doctors and their morphine-addicted patients was that heroin was a safe, non-addictive substitute for morphine. We all know that was a lie.
But they all have the same opium derivative.
Oh sure. The basis of it, yes. Yeah. But this is how it was marketed. And this is how it was marketed even back then, as some sort of savior drug. And it was just hooking people deeper and deeper. So hence the heroin addict was born and has been present in American culture ever since. So heroin is obviously one of the biggest and the nastiest. Have you known anybody who's done heroin or been affected by heroin or anything like that? Or?
Not personally, more friends of friends. I do know friends of friends that have tracks on their arms and have done jail time. I do know a few people. I think I only smoked heroin once.
Wow.
I have a thing about needles. I would never want to try a needle, but I think I did smoke heroin once and it was great. I enjoyed it.
What did it do to you? Did it affect you as I stated, euphoric dream state?
A sort of a dreamy trance-like state. Wow. Yeah, okay. I did enjoy that. But we use the word addiction. We use the word hooked. Is it possible that there are people who are just sort of recreational drug users in the sense that every now and again, they may use cocaine. Every now and again, they may use heroin. I think that we are fed this belief that once you start using heroin, you're hooked. Once you start using cocaine, you're hooked. Surely there are people who just use it every now and again.
I think there is. There certainly is people who can do it on and off or start and stop, and they don't build up a tolerance, I would imagine, so they can still experience the drug in its euphoric states and not become addicted. Now, that would be rare, though. I mean, in my circles or my experience, that it would be rare that people don't become addicted to something along the lines when they're doing these drugs, mm-hmm. whether it be, heroin or cocaine. But
yes.
All right, so let's look at cocaine. So coca is one of the oldest, most potent, and most dangerous stimulants of natural origin. 3,000 years before the birth of Christ, ancient Incas in the Andes chewed coca leaves to get their hearts racing and to speed their breathing to counter the effects of living up in the mountain air.
Oh, yes, yes.
So they would use it. Native Peruvians chewed coca leaves only during religious ceremonies. This taboo was broken when Spanish soldiers invaded Peru in 1532. Those darn Spanish again, forced Indian laborers.
I hate my roots.
You shouldn't. So forced Indian laborers in Spanish silver mines So forced Indian laborers in Spanish silver mines were kept supplied with coca leaves because it made them easier to control and exploit. So they had these guys down in these mines chewing on these leaves and they would do whatever they said.
You know, a friend of mine went to Machu Picchu recently and brought me back some coca candy. Oh, I don't know how they got it through the airport. I mean, apparently he realized in hindsight he actually smuggled it, but he just thought he bought me candy, put it in his bag, came back to the United States. So he brought me this coca candy, and it was awesome. Jeremy, have you tried the coca candy?
I've actually had coca tea in Peru. So,
yeah? Wow.
Yeah.
And how was it?
I mean, they say that it's common use for altitude sickness in Peru, and that's why people do it. I mean, I didn't feel high or anything, but
no euphoric effect.
No, not from the tea. I think it has to be pretty refined to be able to give you that effect.
Okay. Now, did you had the effects from the...
Yes, when I had a couple of these candies...
And that was an illegal product.
And these were hard candies.
Wow.
I don't know if it was illegal to bring them out of that country or illegal to bring them in this country, but apparently he realized in hindsight that he did something illegal. Okay. So he brought me a little sack of about 20 of these hard candies. When I would have two of them, I felt it. I did. I felt a little rush. It felt great. I was jonesing. Afterwards, I was like, got any more of those candies, man? He didn't have any more.
Well, there you go. So cocaine is powerful, for sure. But cocaine was first isolated or extracted from coca leaves in 1859, again, by the Germans. What are they doing? So they're making heroin. They're making cocaine. Wow. So
I never knew this. This is an education. I never knew that.
1859 by German chemist Albert Niemann, I believe that's.
Oh, is that why Freud was into cocaine? He was German.
Was he?
Yeah, they said Freud is German, I believe, and he was into cocaine, I believe.
Wow. Well, Albert Neumann, let me spell that in case I'm saying that wrong, N-E-I-M-A-N-N. It was not until the 1880s that it started to be popularized in the medical community. So then cocaine became, you know, part of the, you know, anesthetic and things that they would put on, you know, instead of the morphines, I guess. It's a whole nother topical, some sort of... injectable.
Well, that I don't understand is
anesthetic, makes you numb.
Is if you have morphine as a painkiller, how would cocaine work as a painkiller?
I think it's some sort of, it's a different version of painkiller. Huh? I really don't know how they differ as far as pain relief, but I know they differ as far as, you know, the usage and what you feel from it. Now, alcohol. Let's go through a quick little timeline on alcohol. We all know alcohol is just as a potent, right?
Sure.
In mass quantities or, you know, whatever your tolerance is, then all of these drugs maybe together. I mean, certainly cocaine or heroin could stop your heart or blow your heart up, but alcohol can knock you out, right? Well, it can make you black out.
I think one of the problems also, what I've been realizing lately is I've been drinking a little more lately, the last year or so.
Okay.
I realize how socially acceptable it is to drink. So I think that makes it more dangerous. I mean, I cannot go tell a stranger that I'm going to take a hit of acid tonight, but I can easily say, yeah, I'm going to have a couple of cocktails. I'm going to have a couple of beers.
Sure.
It's so easy to reveal that. It's so socially acceptable to drink.
Right. Sure. And then that has become that way since the 30s?
Well, after Prohibition, sure.
Where it wasn't socially acceptable. So,
yeah.
All right. So let's look at a quick timeline here. So 8,000 BC, all right, in Persia and the Middle East, a fermented drink is produced from honey and wild yeast. So that was the first time people, you know, drank something fermented and felt the effects. 4,000 BC, so 4,000 years later, winemaking is established in Mesopotamia or modern-day Iraq. All right, so 4,000 years ago, we had wine. Then 3,000 years BC, both beer and wine are produced in ancient Egypt. Wine production and the trade became an important part of the Mediterranean commerce. 1516, here we go again with the Germans. Germany passes a beer purity law, making it illegal to make beer with anything but barley, hops, and pure water.
I always get
Germans
an education.
Germans were way into this. They were way into this being intoxicated. were they not?
I think human nature. I think I think as we realize, I always get a good education whenever I listen to. Because one thing I want to say to the listener, I'm also a listener of Devils in the Details.
Oh, good. Thanks,
and man. I always get a good education. And I think one thing we're learning already is that people enjoy the human species, arguably even animals too, enjoy being intoxicated.
I believe they do, man. I believe you're absolutely right about that. We're all looking for some sort of escape. And, you know, I would like to say that the people who cannot take the route of the mind alterance, I think I have respect for that strong will. But, hey.
Well, if there are people, I mean, people, they say, I've never done drugs. One of my comedian friends, Ron Swallow, never had a drink, never had any drugs, never smoked pot. Great.
No way.
Great. I got no problem with that.
Really?
Yeah. And I also respect that he has no problem with other people who do drugs.
Right.
Yeah, well,
that's good.
I was what you would call a straight edge until I was 23 years old. And
really?
You're a late bloomer.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I didn't try marijuana until I was 26.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what held you off? What kept you away from it?
It was a lifestyle thing. I grew up in kind of the hardcore music scene on the East Coast, and, wow. and it was
it was a movement, the straight edge movement.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a division of the hardcore music scene is to be straight edge, and wow. it was very hardline straight edge. So it was beaten into you in that scene to abstain from any drugs or mm-hmm. alcohol or smoking or anything. Premarital sex was wow. part of it at one point. Huh. Yeah, wow. I got so frustrated with not being able to be myself in certain social situations that's what pushed me finally to just say, you know what, I want to know what I'm actually afraid of. So I'm going to try it. And
rest assured, wow. Climb, yeah. Jeremy has thrown all those rules out the window now.
Out the window.
You know, he's making his choices as an adult, and he certainly has that right. Okokay, so now let's look at this. In 1862, check this out. Abraham Lincoln imposes a new tax on liquor to help pay the bills for the Civil War. So the money that was being created by the alcohol movement was certainly enough to pay for a war. So what does that tell you?
A lot of
people were drinking, right? So 1920, the passage of the 18th Amendment, prohibition, that was the prohibition, and the Volstead Act effectively outlawed the production, sale, and transportation of alcoholic beverages in the United States.
And this was promoted by Puritans, so to speak, people of that puritanical belief, ultra-religious conservative people, right, that spawned the prohibition movement. Is that correct?
I believe it was. I think that society was trying to blame just the outward, the wild, raucous behavior of the inner cities or the new immigrant populations mm-hmm. or communities. I believe they were blamed for a lot of the behavior that, you know, that alcohol brought on. And yep. they almost were playing the race card back then in trying to pass that.
Oh, there's a lot of racism going on in the drug wars. We'll probably get into that a little further too.
And they were just certainly trying to scare people and mm-hmm. say, you know, the poor people or the immigrants are going to get you. So it was all ridiculous. But so the 1920 to 1933, the alcohol trade booms
because it was 13 years. Prohibition was 13 years.
Yes. So it was that was the Al Capone years.
Oh,
and all
I didn't
that
know it was that
crazy
long.
Crazy stuff. 1933, prohibition is repealed. So that's good. The most states restrict youth under 18 from possessing or consuming alcoholic beverages. Now, there's a chart on here I want to show you. This is causes of death from data from 2009. And alcohol does register on this list at 24,518 alcohol-induced deaths. Now, I want you to look at the bottom of that, and I want you to read to me what is the last noted thing there.
Oh, this is an easy one, of course.
Okay.
Zero deaths. Marijuana. Cannabis.
Interesting. So no deaths related to cannabis, but we have diseases of the heart, 500,000, cerebrovascular diseases, 128,000, and so on. So there you go. So
and yet marijuana is illegal.
It's illegal.
At the federal level, to be exact. And also, you know, if we're going to get into a little bit of my personal opinion here, why am I? I disagree with medicinal marijuana. Okay. I believe in marijuana and the decriminalization of marijuana. I don't think I should have to feign a back injury or depression to just enjoy marijuana.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that. You know, I certainly would agree with you not wanting to become a patient in order to, you know, express yourself or, you know, express your individual rights. I agree with that. So tobacco, do we have to talk about tobacco? Tobacco is ridiculous. Cigarettes, you don't smoke cigarettes.
I don't smoke cigarettes. I've tried two cigarettes in my life. First time I didn't enjoy it. Second time I actually enjoyed it.
Did you?
And so because I enjoyed it, I said, I'm never going to do this again because I actually like this. Is the second time I was on a balcony with this girl named Eva. She was smoking a cigarette. I joined her. I smoked it. I liked it. I said, I'm never doing it again.
Wow. Well, I do enjoy cigars. So that is tobacco. Yes. But tobacco has a long history in America. The Mayan Indians of Mexico carved drawings in stone showing tobacco use dating back to somewhere between 600 and 900 A.D. Tobacco was grown by American Indians before the Europeans came from England, Spain, France, and Italy. Native Americans smoked tobacco through a pipe for special religious and medical purposes. So that's the peace pipe, I guess.
Now, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but one of the problems is people say tobacco is so terrible. Mm-hmm. But are we talking tobacco in its natural form or tobacco in its present form with all the additives and all the drugs put into it?
Well, the death figures I just gave you would certainly be from tobacco in today's form. You know,
so in other words,
with all the additives.
The tobacco that the Native Americans smoked hundreds of years ago Was that as terrible as the tobacco today?
I don't know. That's a very good question.
I would say absolutely not.
You would say it would be more safe, something more natural.
There's so much that's put into a cigarette to do things as simple as keep a cigarette lit.
There's chemicals that are added to it.
Yeah.
Sure.
The filter itself is actually more harmful than if you were just to smoke raw tobacco, mm-hmm. you know. There's so many things put in cigarettes that are really bad for you.
Yeah. Poisons, tars. Yeah, deadly stuff. So let me give you the end of the information on cigarettes here. It wasn't until James Boonsack invented the cigarette-making machine in 1881 that cigarette smoking became widespread. Boonsack's cigarette machine could make 120,000 cigarettes a day. He went into business with Washington Duke's son, James Duke. They built a factory and made 10 million cigarettes their first year and 1 billion cigarettes 5 years later. The first brand of cigarettes were packaged in a box with baseball cards and were called Duke of Durham. Buck Duke and his father started the first tobacco company in the United States. They named it the American Tobacco Company. Now, it also helped, you know, the tobacco was one of the original cash crops along with hemp. Now, we're not going to go into hemp because that's obviously not a drug.
Sure.
But everybody grew that back then. You know, it was just something that you had to have.
But this is one of my fears. We briefly talked about all the additives put into tobacco. So now that marijuana is decriminalized for medicinal purposes, mm-hmm. I wonder, what are they putting in pot now that they didn't put in it 20 years ago? That's what I wonder.
I don't know.
Does pot have all the additives, or starting to have the additives that tobacco?
I don't believe so. If you're speaking in the medicinal
yes.
marijuana vein,
now, what somebody gets the dispensary, let's say.
No, they do all sorts of things with it. I mean, they certainly bake with it. They create all sorts of things.
Sure, soda pop candies.
Yeah, like oils.
But are they putting harsh chemicals in medicinal marijuana like they do with tobacco?
I would say no. I would say the growing procedures and techniques have improved to increase the potency of it, but I don't think anything's being added directly, but I certainly could be wrong.
I hope that you're right.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because
sure.
I would hate to believe that because it's now legal for medicinal purposes, that means chemicals.
Right. Well, let's hope not. So cigarettes are legal because they are not as addictive or dangerous, right? Isn't that a silly question?
Oh, yeah.
So the Centers for Disease Control, check these numbers out, man. Cigarette smoking causes about one of every five deaths in the United States. Wow.
It's linked to cigarette smoking.
Yes. Cigarette smoking is estimated to cause the following: 443,000 deaths annually, 49,400 deaths per year from secondhand smoke, 269,000 deaths among men, and 173,000 among women. Crazy.
So you don't have to be a social critic or a conspiracy theorist to ask yourself, why would marijuana, which has zero deaths linked to it, be illegal, yet cigarettes, which have thousands and thousands of deaths, be legal?
Ah, well, that brings us to marijuana. So let's just take a look. Marijuana or cannabis, huh? What do we have here? So regulations and restrictions on the sale of cannabis sativa as a drug began as early as 1860 as part of local poison laws. In the middle of the 1930s, all member states of the United States had some regulation of cannabis. In 1936, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics noticed an increase of reports of people smoking marijuana, which further increased in 1937. The Bureau drafted a legislature plan for Congress seeking a new law, and the head of the FBN, Harry J. Anslinger, who is the guy you hear about in all the pot prohibition movies, he is the man who is credited with starting this, war on drugs.
And this is during the era of the Reefer Madness movie, right?
Yes.
Didn't it come out about?
Yes.
Yes.
That was exactly around the same time. And that was the sort of propaganda that Anslinger got behind.
Yes.
So he would run smear campaigns against marijuana. During the particular time frame, the media was swarmed with propaganda regarding the effects of marijuana. So Henry Anslinger, a dominant leader in the prohibition against drugs, devised advertisements and commercials to inform the public of the believed side effects of marijuana, all that crazy stuff. Citizens who were high on marijuana were crazy, insane, suicidal, and had murderous intentions, according to the propaganda, disregarding the scientific research on the subject, and they would falsify the claims, they would disregard the scientific research and falsify the claims.
Well, thank you for mentioning the word propaganda, because, when people think of propaganda, they may think of China with Chairman Mao, they may think of the Nazi era. They don't imagine propaganda right here on this soil in the United States We are spoon-fed propaganda.
Every day. Every day, if you watch the local news, you're fed propaganda. Sure, absolutely. And in commercials, if you watch those as well.
Except for the University of Phoenix commercial.
That's the best commercial there is. That's my favorite one. I like the guy who's building the shelves.
He's a good actor.
He's my favorite. He's a handsome guy. All right, so Marijuana Tax Act was passed in 1937, quickly and with little debate and no opposition in Congress. So they just got rid of marijuana in one swoop in 1937. And the American Medical Association, AMA, supported a federal law but recommended that marijuana be added to the Harrison Narcotic Act. The restrictions for cannabis was part of a broad international trend supported by the president.
Before the scheduling, though, right?
I believe that Narcotic Act was indeed the scheduling.
Oh, okay, because I thought Nixon did the scheduling.
The tiers or
yes,
whatever it is.
Yes, exactly. Schedule one, schedule two. In other words, putting marijuana in the same category as heroin, I believe.
Yeah, we don't like him either. Yeah, which is not good, obviously. So looking at the chart of deaths, marijuana alone has led to zero deaths. We saw that on the chart.
Can I mention something also?
Go right ahead. You know,
people say, and even pro-marijuana advocates will say, marijuana should be legal, but you can't drive a car. You know, I think people have this belief because they think, well, you can't drink and drive, so surely you can't smoke and drive. I would challenge anyone to a driving test while I am under the influence of marijuana. I will not crash. I will not dent. I will get us there. I might get us lost, but I will get us there safely.
Well, there you go. So you'll be lost but safe.
That's right.
All right. I believe you. I've driven with you. I believe you. All right. So let's listen to the Harry J. Jacob Anslinger. You can learn about him in any one of these marijuana prohibition movies, how weed won the West and all of that. But let's listen to Mr. Anslinger's own voice just to see what kind of guy he was. So let's check Mr. Anslinger out.
Tends to pursue a relentless warfare against the despicable dope-peddling vulture who preys on the weakness of his fellow man.
You dick!
We would have to thank another one of our stoner legends, Mr. Jeff Spicoli, right?
Is that who that was?
That is.
You dick!
And Anslinger would definitely deserve that.
That was my skull!
How could we not mention drugs without mentioning Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Are we going to go into Cheech and Chong since we're mentioning Jeff Spicoli?
Well, let's... Yes, we're gonna get to that point, but let's do this. So we are going to move on now. There's a lot of interesting information about drug use in the 50s, and you can go online and check out like New York Times articles from the 50s, and it tells you all about the drug usage and the fact that they had counted 44,000 narcotic addicts back in the 50s doing heroin and all sorts of bad things, and it really shows that drugs really had a hold on a large number of society even back then. Mm-hmm. But let's move into the 1960s. So if we're moving out of the 50s, I was going to play Blueberry Hill, but why not? Let's just take it a little quick here. Blueberry Hill. Now, there's an interesting fact to Blueberry Hill, and I don't think he was going up there with a girl, so he found his thrill up on top of the hill.
Right? I never knew that what you're getting at is that it meant something.
Much time with old fats.
I found my thrill.
Now, what is old fats talking about, right?
I never knew. Okay. I never knew what you're getting at. I never knew.
Well, now you know. All right. So, I believe he was finding his thrill up on top of the Blueberry Hill, if you know what I mean.
Wow, with
wink,
reefer.
Wink, yeah.
Wow.
So, all right. So let's say goodbye to the 50s. Look any information up on drug use in the 50s. It is amazing, and that is long before our fictitious war on drugs, or we had that old version under Mr. Anslinger. But so let's look at the 60s. Now, what we want to talk about in the 60s is the proliferation of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll era. So let's start that off with something like this. So with the 60s came the Pusher Man and great movies like Easy Rider, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Where that comes from. And as the fears and memories of the World War faded, so we moved into the era of the 60s. So
the Trip with Peter Sellers?
Was it a good one?
Yeah.
All right. I got to check that one out. Now, the youth of this generation watched in horror as their daily lives were converted out of the Richie Cunningham happy days to the turbulent tyranny of a civil rights movement bloodied by racist anger, right? The same evil hands that claimed the souls of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were the same evil hands that destroyed an American Camelot and chiseled our young soldiers into the black granite monuments of Washington, D.C.
Who is that? Your writing or is that a quote?
That's me. That's Wyme.
Wow.
We're Wyming it up today, baby.
That's impressive. I like that.
Oh, well, we're not done yet. We got pages. Okay, so here we go. As the 60s saw its fair share of cigarettes, alcohol, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana, which are what we're talking about, the 60s would mostly be known for its psychedelic drug
decade. Yeah.
It was known as the psychedelic drug decade.
Yeah.
Was it?
Well, no.
What do you think?
When I was a kid, I would watch images of Woodstock on PBS specials.
Yeah.
And I would see these naked painted girls gyrating around right there in the concert grassy area. And I just thought, how can I get there? What do I have to do? And unfortunately, I realized I was born too late.
Oh. Well, there was a Woodstock in our era.
It's not the same.
No. Of course, there's Ken Kesey and
you know what?
Timothy Leary and... You know, those guys defined, you know, the beginning of the hippie movement with
the magic
bus and the acid
further.
Tests and all those things.
The electric Kool-Aid acid test.
Electric Kool-Aid acid test. Great by Tom Wolfe. Tom Wolfe, yeah. So let's take a look here. So let's look into the lysergic world of, as you mentioned, Mr. Timothy Leary. So this is some interesting stuff on him. Let's see if we can get through this. Now, known for the life patterns, he was known for the life pattern of turn on, tune in, and drop out. Timothy Leary was a professor at Harvard when he began experimenting with psilocybin, acid, and other hallucinogens. His test subjects included prominent Bohemian luminaries like Thelonious Monk, Aldous Huxley, Allen Ginsberg, William S. Burroughs, and Jack Kerouac. Is that the correct? That's the correct
way. I believe so.
Okay. After running low on beatniks, he switched to prison inmates, homeless people, and religious students, which is weird, right? Leary argued publicly that hallucinogens could be used to treat personality disorders, but ultimately these beliefs got him booted from Harvard, so he got kicked out. His lifelong enthusiasm for tripping out would quickly be overshadowed. Would quickly overshadow his acclaim as one of America's most innovative psychologists. So he was kind of big time in that field.
And apparently, are you going to talk about this? The U.S. government believed that too. You can alter someone's consciousness and create a psychosis in a person with LSD. And so they would experiment. The government experimented with LSD. Are you going to get into that?
Wow. It was just the information about Leary himself. He was actually arrested. He was actually arrested with LSD on him. He was sentenced to 30 years and actually escaped jail. So that was an interesting fact on Leary. He was caught years later and turned snitch on his...
You mean physically escaped?
He escaped, man. He got 30 years and he escaped.
Oh, wow.
He's turned snitch. Once he was caught, he turned snitch on his fellow escapee and was sentenced... It was reduced to 3 years. He went on to promote that Hollywood and the internet, you know, in the modern era, Hollywood and the internet would be the LSD of the 90s. So he believed that somehow the conglomeration of the two would be that mind alterant, which maybe it turned out to be, right?
I probably wouldn't argue with that.
Well, you never know. So he died of prostate cancer May 31st, 96 at the age of 75. His effect on American culture has blazed trails through creative planes and also allowed the artists of this era to experiment and profit from drug-induced sounds and antics. The 60s would bring the beloved iconography of Ken Kesey, Neil Cassidy, and the Merry Pranksters driving around in a psychedelic school bus named Further. Drugs would claim many lives dear to us in the 60s, Marilyn Monroe, Lenny Bruce, and Brian Jones, just to name a few. He, of course, is the co-founder of the Rolling Stones. As organized crime mainly profited from the illicit drug trade, the media began to wake up. Media began to wake up and be responsive to a profit-filled tie-dyed youth. Right? A youth still stinging from the intolerant parents of the 60s. This young group now accepted the media's interpretation of their behavior and called this lifestyle culture. Right? From hallucinogens, pot, and backroom heroin galleries, cocaine was about to reveal itself as the most deadly and profitable substance on the face of the earth. All right. So that's going to move us to our next section. Let's listen to this. Sorry about that. Let's check this one out. This is going to move us to the 70s.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, you bring back all those colors to my dreams. Silver magic ships you
all right.
carry.
So that brings us into the 70s, 1970s, Sal, man. Here we go. So this was when we were born, I believe.
73 was a good year.
I don't want to put you out there, but so this was this is when we started to live.
Yeah.
As we move from the drug and love discovery of the 60s, we dive into the era of discos, the sexual revolution, and cocaine kingpins. The 70s is when the energetic Technicolor dance floors were under a constant Colombian snowstorm. We saw the growth of the marijuana subculture with Cheech and Chong and the first issue of High Times magazine, as well as a nation thrown into a plight of drug use and the deconstruction of family values. So the world, so is the world of the cocaine cowboys and the nation building Colombian cocaine drug trade. Now, a lot of this information comes from the film's Cocaine Cowboys. Did you get a chance to take a look at that? Or?
I did have a look at the Cocaine Cowboys.
What did you think of the Cocaine Cowboys?
I liked it. It was good.
All right. Well, it's interesting stuff, man. It tells us the true tales of the rise of billionaire Colombian drug lords. You know, these guys down in Colombia were trying to get it all going, you know, back in the 70s, mid-70s. We learned that not only was Florida the coast open to drug smuggling, but it was the reason the city of Miami was transformed into the city it is today. Interesting to note, this is when our government was covertly planning their own nefarious ways to profit from the drug trade, as the East Coast mafia families were struggling to compete with the Colombians importing directly into Miami. This is when we first are introduced to the Medellin cocaine drug empire. Most notable of this bunch, of course, is Pablo Escobar. But ultimately, a woman rose the ranks of murderous drug kingpins to control most of the cocaine traffic in the U.S. from the late 70s to the early 90s. This woman, of course, being none other than Griselda Blanco. She operated as the U.S. arms of the Medellin drug cartel. She was their distributor here in America. She was known to have imported tons of cocaine, making billions of dollars. She was also known to be the most deadly of these drug lords, male or female. It didn't really matter. She left no ex-husband alive. And if you cross Griselda, she'd kill you. So with the help of notorious drug smugglers Mickey Munday and John Roberts, which you can learn about in Cocaine Cowboys, these two men tell the tales that would make Sonny Crockett and Rico Tubbs, might be showing my age there, foam at the mouth. So if you don't know who they are, they're from a show called Miami Vice, which was also a show from that era about the cocaine drug trade.
Miami Vice with Jamie Foxx, yes.
There you go. which is about the same thing, right? Same era. I don't know. I haven't seen that one, so I'm showing my age. So anyway, so the talk of starting the drug, they started with a few $100s, started this crazy cocaine distribution and importation.
I mean, this is Tony Montana come to life.
This you know what's interesting about this stories, Cocaine Cowboy stories, is that when you wonder how they write it such an amazing movie like Scarface, you kind of wonder how they come up with all of that. But when you read these or listen to these stories, you learn that most of it is based on reality, and,
yeah,
and most of it is based on what's here. So they started with just a few dollars, and they ended up making $30,000 to $4,000 a week, and then on up to millions. So let's move forward in the 70s. Here we go. Here we go. Pardon me. Let's move a little forward in the 70s. That's the dramatics. I like that one. I had to throw that one in there. All right. So the only way for Griselda to grow was to cut out rival gang suppliers. So it had gone on for many years. This would lead to the deadliest era in the drug war. And that's what we learn about. Griselda's group was known for dismembering their enemies and leaving them in wrapped packages. They used bombs to destroy their houses, even murdered a mother and father in the presence of their children. When Mickey, John, and Griselda were making millions in the coke trade, so was the business. So was every business that supported the Golden Spoon Society. Hundreds of banks sprang up, car dealerships sold record numbers of cars, as did jewelry and clothing stores.
Were those all fronts? Were those money laundering fronts? Is that what that was?
I think they were just every retailer that catered to that crowd was doing well back then.
Oh, got it. Almost like concierge services.
Possibly so, but they were selling, I mean, you know, Mercedes is out the door, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. But what an interesting part to all of this in the 70s is the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, obviously, we don't have a lot of time to go through the Iran-Contra scandal, but do you briefly kind of know what that was?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially...
All right, go for it. What do you got on the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, especially after watching the great video based on Gary Webb investigations.
Yes, very good.
Go to www.alienscientist.com/drugs, and you'll see a great documentary. It's a two-hour documentary. You know, sit back and relax and watch it. And it talks all about the Iran-Contra affair and how it affected Los Angeles in particular.
Wow.
Right here where Skid Row Studios is. In fact, yes. In one part of the documentary, they're actually driving around in this area.
Yes, yes. And they are, and that is the correlation between the Iran-Contras, the CIA bringing the drugs into Freeway Ricky Ross.
Yes. If you watch this documentary, especially as a Californian or Los Angelian, you watch this documentary, you will be very upset.
Yes, for sure. Now, so the Iran-Contra, what it was we had seven people who were kidnapped from our embassy in Lebanon. And this was back in when the turmoil between us and the Iranians was going on. So the Iranian, some Iranian terrorists took our seven people from our embassy and held them hostage. Our government then covertly went behind everyone's back and attempted to trade bombs and weapons for the hostages and all behind the current president's back, which was Jimmy Carter.
And they weren't successful till Ben Affleck did it in Argo, right?
And they were, I don't know.
Oh. Yeah. Isn't that what the movie Argo is about? Them retrieving hostages and posing as a Hollywood film crew
to have Reagan become elected and it make him the big savior. And what they were really doing was trading the weapons to the Iranians to try to get the hostages back. But it was another circle that took the money that took a piece of the money and went to Nicaragua to these rebels that we were trying to have fight these Cuban rebels in Nicaragua. So I know that's confusing, but
we were down with Noriega at the time, right?
We were trying to help push rebels back, these Cuban-based or Soviet-based rebels out of Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the money was being funneled in. But the way they created the money for the program covertly was by bringing the cocaine into cities like Los Angeles and to be dealt by the Freeway Ricky Ross.
They brought the cocaine over, and then that cocaine was in turn transformed into crack cocaine.
Yes, yes.
And then that crack cocaine was sold on the streets. So invariably, if somebody bought crack on the streets, that was funneled back to these rebels. Directly.
Directly.
It was a direct chain.
And you know what's interesting about Ricky Ross is that, you know, and please look up Freeway Ricky Ross and all the investigations. We had a little more information, but we don't have the time to go through it. But Ricky Ross brought in millions per week. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of kilos for these Colombians and for all these South Americans, and he would actually bring it in and deal directly for CIA connections. And Ricky didn't know that.
He didn't know that. He didn't find out until later about the connection.
Right.
All he knew was that he was getting cocaine, he was splitting it up, making crack, and getting rich. He didn't know about the upstream, the upline, if you will.
Right. Right. Let's hope not, because you wonder why a lot of these people stay alive, you know, and maybe because they say things like that, or maybe they didn't really know, you know, but...
defend Freeway Ricky Ross.
Okay.
But he was definitely used as a patsy, and other people should have been convicted. Other people should be in jail now, and yet he's in jail. Is he still in jail?
I believe he actually got out of jail.
Oh, he got out of jail. Okay, yeah, because the documentary was made in 2007, right. I believe, yes. Right. So if he's out, great. But, I mean, he was a patsy. He was, and this is where racism maybe comes into it. A lot of people think he was convicted because he was black. He was used as a poster child because he's black. Hmm. Whereas nobody up the chain was black. He was the first black in the chain, if you will. Huh. If you look at the chain from the Contras all the way down through the CIA, he is the only black person who was convicted.
And so you think there might have been a connection there. Well, that's possible. But let's skip through the 80s, man, since we're running low on time. And let's move to the 90s. So what type of drugs did we have in the 90s?
I think 90s is what spawned ecstasy, right?
So at this point, 1985, I believe, with Nancy Reagan and her Just Say No campaign, the zero tolerance, the battering rams, the Ricky Ross crack, infiltrating our inner cities. We had Chief Daryl Gates here in Los Angeles. And this was the era, the Rodney King era. I mean, it was a tumultuous time. We had the L.A. riots.
Yes.
So we had a lot of things going on in the early 90s. But what drugs did we seem to have? around that were new. We always had the constants. So we always had the heroin and the cocaine and the alcohol and the marijuana. But we did have raves.
Yes.
So raves. I'm not the familiar.
I missed them, man. I missed the raves.
Did you miss the raves?
Yeah,
well, I missed them too. But they've been described as some sort of neo-hallucinogenic audio bath. That's mm-hmm. I was speaking to a girl trying to get some information, and she actually told me that that's what it sounded like. So that didn't help me.
I was opening up the gym. Every morning I'm opening up the gym at 6. Mm-hmm. I missed the raves.
Oh. Well, the drugs of choice at a rave was called ecstasy. Now, I've never done ecstasy, and I would tell children to stay away from drugs with names like ecstasy, because these are obviously designed or created by people.
Designer drugs, that's the phrase.
Who knows where. Okay, so designer drugs.
Yes.
And of course, there was cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. But as the subset culture moved to a more peaceful drug-taking experience, the streets of American inner cities were not only littered with crack vials, but the cities themselves were littered with the zombies that crack commonly leaves behind. So we moved out of the 90s, or we moved out of the 80s into this more modern drug-taking, you know, world. But we certainly still had the ramifications of the 80s crack epidemic, so to speak. So this was we were deep in the war on drugs at this point. We were having major crack wars in the street. Here in Los Angeles, you know, you remember those times.
Oh, sure.
On every corner, there was somebody selling something, and it was just a pretty scary place to be. But along in the 90s, another one reared its ugly head, and we would be remiss if we didn't talk about meth.
Oh, sure.
And if you were alive in the early 90s, somebody you know or somebody you love had to be involved with the use of methamphetamine. It had become big business for Hollywood to profit from such scourges like methamphetamine with shows like Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of, you know, through all of this, I'm trying to kind of show, you know, a connection between the media and the marketing of these drugs. You know, they certainly are used to profit, you know, by many groups and entities, but they are also certainly detrimental to our lives. So
I would say that kind of personifies it. You know, there's this image of what is a drug maker, what is a drug dealer. There's this image that people may have, and this then puts a slant on it and personifies it in a different fashion. So in other words, it's not who people thought it was. I mean, this is what Bryan Cranston, mm-hmm. a white man.
I like the show.
Yeah, people don't think...
I love the show.
When people think drug dealers or drug manufacturers mm-hmm. of illegal drugs, they don't right. imagine a guy that looks like Bryan Cranston.
Right. Well, you know, it's well written. I mean, I'm not certainly knocking the show, but I'm just trying to prove the point that Cheech and Chong, you know, all of these, you know, various, you know, marijuana or drug induced movies, you know, they certainly do profit from it. And I certainly don't disagree with that, but I just wanted to prove the point that, you know, not only do people take drugs, but, you know, drugs also make money for industries that have nothing to do with drugs. Well, and they make a pretty penny.
Well, that's the question. Does art reflect life, or does life reflect art?
Right. And let's hope they both reflect each other equally.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. So here are some facts about drugs in the 90s. So let's see. By the last decade of the millennium, it appeared that fewer people were using drugs. Gallup polls showed little change in the percentage of adults who said that they had used marijuana. So 34% of Americans said they had tried it in 1999. According to the Gallup Youth Survey, however, the percentage of teens admitting to marijuana use also continued to drop from 38% in 81 to 20% in 1999. So the PDFA reported that teens' trial use of marijuana, inhalants, methamphetamines, and LSD for the first time had declined in 1999.
So, well, then they can say, see, just say no works.
And then, of
dare
course,
to say no. Dare the DARE program coming to school. See, everybody, it works.
Right. And so that was then, of course, we mentioned the club drugs and all the upswing. Of course, always go to Gallup and find information on drugs. They have a lot of great information there on drug statistics through the years. And you can learn a lot there. But let's just see if we can't touch on this one. You know, this one's important to me. In the 2000s and in the 2010s is it's current time. The drugs that we experience now is on every corner. There's drive-thrus. It's like fast food, right? I mean, on every corner, sure. We have a Walgreens.
Yep.
Or a pharmacy.
In my area, there was a Rite Aid, and right catty corner opened up a Walgreens.
Right. And what are those for? And why do we have such a proliferation of legal pharmacies? And that would be from the ADHD drugs and the like. And I strongly disagree with giving children ADHD drugs. I know that's a hot topic among parents.
Sure.
But I certainly feel that we should parent our children instead of medicating them to become normal or to be considered normal. And a lot of this is would simply be, a child being hyperactive or a child being slower, you know, or more lethargic. And then they either try to wake them up or slow them down. And it's a horribly scary.
And you're a parent, so you can say.
I would never do that to my child. Now certain mental illnesses, obviously beyond ADHD, would certainly need more medical attention. But for ADD and ADHD, for those being such brand new diagnoses, I certainly wouldn't use my child as some sort of lab rat for things like Adderall or Concerta or, Vianaze or, I don't know if I'm saying those wrong, pardon me, but, those drugs are so horribly scary. Because it's what it does is it's creating the next level of adult in this drug induced sexually repressed mm-hmm. state, and they're also they also lead to brain it breaks the brain apart. These drugs actually diminish brain capacity and reduce sexual, I know I said that, but that's important.
I believe it is because there's no outlet then.
Well, when you see that age, 18 to 25 nowadays, well, you can see the effect, the direct effect of these drugs that they've had for the last, 10, 15 years growing up.
Let me ask this question. Sure. Whenever somebody commits a crime, and they're on marijuana, they will always mention it. They will always say, a person on marijuana robbed a liquor store or whatever. But especially all these gun crimes recently, all these shootings, mm-hmm. it never mentions if that person was on any medication. If they were, if they weren't, were they coming off their meds?
Right.
Were they on them? I would like to know.
That's a good question. That's a valid point.
Yeah, I would like to know if any of these people who are committing these massacres with the guns and all in recent times was on pharmaceuticals of the psychotropic nature.
Right. And I believe a lot of them are. Look into that because you'll find a lot of scary stuff there.
Well, where do you look into that? It's the media doesn't mention it. There's no mention of them being on or off or coming off of psychotropic drugs. It doesn't say.
Right. I believe the guy from Aurora did have some sort of psychotropic drugs in his past. Mm-hmm. So who knows if that led up to that eventuality. It certainly was tragic. And, we want to keep those incidents isolated. If I can get those words out, but so we kind of went through our decades. I know that was a mess, but we had some more information for you. Now I will post all the information that I didn't get to on the Devils in the Details Radio Show Facebook page.
You're good about that.
And we'll get all that information up for you. The stuff we missed, the 80s, 90s, Griselda Blanco. There's a whole nother Cocaine Cowboys movie, which is Cocaine Cowboys Part 2, where she reared her ugly head again. And there, she became, dealing drugs from prison. But let me read my final thoughts if I can, and let's just see if we can get through this. So, governments starting wars to sell drugs to line their pockets, and nations building skylines with profits from the death of our soldiers and children. Private for-profit prisons brimming with so many criminals, they can't build prisons fast enough. Now, none of this makes sense to me. And as our nation starves and suffers from billion-dollar bailouts and a trillion-dollar war on drugs, there is yet to be a shortage of any drug at any time. You have to ask yourself, is it possible our government would murder its own citizens to fund a covert rebel war against a foreign nation, or replant a world of heroin profits to stimulate a dying world financial system? Now, that's what you really got to ask yourself, and we didn't get into that. But kind of look into the poppy world and how they've all been replanted over there in Afghanistan. I think it's proven that Obama's armies are hypocritically threatening the green industries of medical marijuana while Oprah and Ellen sell the warning-laden psychotropic promises of well-behaved children. Please study these topics. And if you have children, it's necessary to have discussions with them about drugs and alcohol and about the pressures that all children face at a certain age in their lives. And we all did it. And we either succumb to it or we rise above it. We either join in or we move forward in life. And thank you for joining me today, man. I had a great ball. I had a great time talking to you. Do you have anything to say in closing? Do you have any plugs or anywhere we can find you?
Thanks, Juan. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate being here. I really had a great time. Really, if you look at the drug war and you look at the pharmaceutical industry and you look at the prison system, and if you don't get angry, there's something wrong with you, essentially.
Right.
That's what I believe.
I agree with you.
So thank you for having me on. I advise invite everyone to listen to Registered Ear Offenders every Friday, 1 p.m., right here on SkidRowStudios.com.
Outstanding. And also, check the Facebook page, Devils in the Details Radio Show. Any questions or comments or corrections, please post them, and I will get back to you personally. So thank you very much for joining me today and me and Sal today on the Devils in the Details Radio Show, and I'll see you next week.